What time is it?
Hello and welcome to the Bible Dig Godcast, a fun-filled exploration of archaeology and the Bible. And now, here are your hosts, author J.S. Earls and attorney Peter A. Papoutsis.
Hello and welcome to a important episode of the Bible Dig Podcast. Not that other ones are not important, but this is going to be a little bit of a change because we are going to be transitioning from the Genesis time period to the Gospels time period. One of the reasons why we are making this change is because there is a lot more archaeological stuff we can go over that will really shore up your faith. And honestly, there's a lot of attack against historic Christianity and even whether Jesus existed, which is a little bit hilarious to me because even people who are atheists and hardcore Muslims or other things now have pretty much said, even if they don't think that he's the son of God or whatever, you can't deny that he existed. There's way too much evidence. Way too many people have seen stuff. Way too many other people and just historically have written things about him. But even within a lot of the churches, especially the progressive church, very much teaching other things and really downplaying Christ. And so we definitely, in some ways, that we need to take a stand and take a stand for Christ and really start getting into who Christ is and what evidence we have for not just Christ, but everything around that time period and the way that it exploded into history. I did want to add that I know I said we would be doing some recent archaeological discoveries at the beginning. Honestly, they happen so much now and so many things are going on that the best thing for you to do is go to our Facebook page because as soon as things break, we post it on our Facebook page. And I am mentioning this now because even some people have recently found us. And shout out to you people who have been messaging us on Facebook. It's so funny. It's one of those things where it's in the end of almost every single episode, but it's just like so many things that people just, you hear it and you're not really thinking about it or listening to like what is actually saying, because our wonderful announcer will say at the end of every episode, you know, join us on our Facebook page. But I know people just get so used to it, or they're waiting to see if we have bloopers or whatever that you're not really actually, it's not going in. So I did want to say towards the beginning of the episode, yes, please check out our Facebook page. And if you have questions and different things like that, we're usually very good to get back to you. And like I said, as news breaks on different discoveries, we post them and we post the direct links to usually the one of the best sources for those things.
Go to Facebook, Bible Dig. Yeah.
Yep. Now that we got all the business out of the way, where do you want to start, Pete?
We can actually start with Isaac because a lot of people would probably be surprised if they remember a little teaser that we put into some of our older Bible Dig podcasts about, you know, that the birth of Isaac was somehow, what's the word? Interesting? Mysterious? That, you know, people, you know, they read this story with, you know, the three angels coming and telling Abraham that, you know, the child of promise, quote unquote, to quote the words of St. Paul, that's what he actually calls Isaac in the New Testament, the child of promise, which is actually very interesting, is not going to be Ishmael, but is actually going to be a child of Sarah's, meaning it's going to come from Sarah. It's going to come from your wife, your 90-year-old plus wife. And, you know, that's where, you know, everybody knows the story. Sarah laughed and, you know, the angel said, why did you laugh? And that's actually the basis of Isaac's name. In Hebrew, Isaac's name means, you know, laughter or he who laughs or something like that. And I'm not a Hebrew scholar. I just remember learning that in Bible studies many, many, many moons ago. But if you read the biblical text and you analyze it, and you don't even have to analyze it that much, you just have to read it, there's a question whether Abraham is the actual father of Isaac. Sarah is the mother, no doubt about that. But who fathered Isaac? Was it really Abraham?
And it's sort of, yeah, like you're saying, through omission, because there's the way the language of the Bible is very specific with saying from Sarah and other things. And there's very specific language that is, if you go back and wasn't that long ago when we were talking about like after the flood and other things, where the Bible is very specific about the way that it says that people are born and who they come from and stuff like that.
Right.
And a lot of times they're especially connecting it to the fathers.
Right.
And they don't do that with Isaac. So there's been some different opinions, and we're not saying, oh, this changes everything or whatever. It's just, if anything, it just points even more so towards Christ and towards the virgin birth of Christ. And as Pete will explain, is one reason why that it wasn't such an outlandish idea for him to be born of a virgin birth.
No, not at all. In fact, one of the things that is very interesting, and I'm just going to throw it out generally out there, and we'll develop it as we go along, is that there's this ancient Jewish mentality, and then there's this post-Christian Jewish mentality, that there really is a schism between the two mindsets of Jewish thought, which a lot of the pre-Christian Jewish mentality is still present within like Orthodox Judaism, Hasidim Judaism, Kabbalistic Judaism. So that mentality is still there. But when you get into the more modern forms of Judaism, like Reformed and Conservative, it's completely gone. So when you go into this older Jewish understanding of the Torah, like you said, there's an omission in regards to who the father of Isaac is. You assume from reading the text that it's Abraham, but if you really look at the text, it's not that clear that it's Abraham. So when you actually look at the text, and one of the areas that we got the information from is Torah.com. So if you go to Torah.com and go under the heading Isaac's Divine Conception, they actually go through the ancient Jewish belief that Isaac was divinely conceived. And this is presented by a rabbi by the name of Dr. Rabbi Samuel Z. Glaser, G-L-A-S-E-R. And it starts off with this very interesting thesis by Rabbi Glaser, where it says, "The Lord visited Sarah," okay, that's in Genesis 21:1, "when God and his angels," remember we had the three angels, "appear to Abraham to announce the birth of Isaac, the text implies a hidden visit to Sarah," meaning by the angels or by God. So Rabbi Glaser says, does this mean, as both the ancient Jewish philosopher Philo and St. Paul in the New Testament claim, that Isaac was born from a divine conception, i.e. parthenogenesis, i.e. a virgin birth? Because if you actually read the text, it says, after Abraham circumcises his household and himself, God appears to him while he is sitting in his tent. As the story unfolds, Abraham sees three men standing near him." Okay, so those are the angels there at the tree of Mamre. We already talked about that. "According to the straightforward reading of the text, it is God plus the two angels, therefore the three angels, that are there at the Oak of Mamre talking to Abraham. And after they eat their meal, they," meaning the angels and God and his angels, the divine council, "they inquire about his wife Sarah. And they said to him, 'Where is your wife Sarah?' And Abraham replied, 'There in the tent.'" Okay, so the focus, what Rabbi Glaser says, the focus is not on Abraham. It's on Sarah. It's on Sarah. And the text says, that God said, I will return to you at the due season, and your wife Sarah shall have a son. Sarah was listening at the entrance of the tent, which was behind him, and she laughed. And they said, why did you laugh? You know, and she said, I didn't laugh. And she said, yeah, you did laugh. Anyway, this it's within this exchange that when the angels do come back, or, you know, when the time comes for the visitation by the angels, Sarah's conceived. Sarah has a son, Isaac. But when you read the text, like we were saying before, it doesn't say, and Abraham, you know, knew his wife Sarah, and they gave birth to a son. That is all missing. That is always the pattern of how you see it in the biblical text before and after this story. You know, Abraham, in fact, you see that with Hagar. You know, Abraham knew Hagar and brought forth Ishmael.
Right.
You don't have that with Isaac. And guess who noticed that? The rabbis noticed that. The rabbis noticed this problem, and then they started to offer some explanations. Okay, these are the pre-Christian old Jewish thought rabbis. And so Rabbi Glaser says that this is how they explained it. They said to him, where, meaning God and the angels, where is your wife Sarah? And he replied, there in the tent. The rabbi says, this comes to teach that our mother Sarah was modest. Rabbi Yehuda said in the name of Rav, and some say Rabbi Yitzhak or Isaac, the ministering angels knew that our mother Sarah was in the tent, so that was the question leading to Abraham's response in the tent, in order to make her beloved to her husband. But, you know, was it Abraham that went into the tent to visit Sarah? Because it wasn't Abraham that it was inquiring. God was inquiring. So who was it that went into the tent and visited Sarah and gave this cup of blessing, as the rabbis would say, to Sarah? And so, because it was only God that was inquiring, not Abraham. And so what the rabbis are saying is that God is the one that visited Sarah. God was the one that said, well, Isaac, or, you know, your issue is going to be your child of promise. Not the child of your seed, not the child of your issue, but the child of the promise, my promise that I'm promising to you. Okay? So in the first scene, God and the two angels are speaking with Abraham. And the next scene, when we go into the biblical text, which I believe is chapter 21 or chapter 22, I can't remember right now, only one announces Sarah's pregnancy and the future birth of Isaac, and that's God. In between these two speeches, the angels entered the tent to be with Sarah. Not Abraham, the angels. Okay, so stop there. Where else do we see God making an announcement and then angels being in the presence of somebody else, and then a miraculous birth takes place? Well, go read Luke. Go read the Gospel according to St. Luke. You have God making a pronouncement through the angel Gabriel to Mary, and next you have the birth of Jesus. Joseph is nowhere around. That's the biblical pattern. That is the biblical pattern of a divine conception, parthenogenesis, virgin birth. And so the rabbis picked up on this in the pre-Christian era, that Isaac was the child of promise and that he was conceived because God inquired about Sarah. God was the one that visited Sarah, not Abraham. Genesis 21:1. Yahweh, God, visited Sarah as he had promised, and Yahweh, God, did for Sarah as he had spoken, or again, promised, the child of promise. Okay? Nowhere in this do we have Abraham. It's only God and Sarah. God and Sarah. God and Sarah. So when you have that, the rabbis were saying, that's a divine conception. And not only was it the rabbis that were saying that, but somebody else was saying it too, and that was Philo of Alexandria. Philo of Alexandria is very close now to the Christian era. and Philo of Alexandria, is the most influential Jewish Hellenistic philosopher of his age. Okay, this is what Rabbi Glazer said about Philo. Philo explicitly read the account of Isaac's birth as referring to a divine conception. So Philo is well within the old rabbinic pre-Christian Jewish thought that Isaac was of a virgin birth or of a divine conception. He believed, meaning Philo, that an important philosophical mystery was inherent in the story of Isaac's birth. Isaac represented joy, his name means laughter, because he is one with the power behind the universe. This is because Isaac is actually God's son and not Abraham's son. That's ancient Jewish thought. That's Philo of Alexandria, all pre-Christian. Well, guess who else picks up on this? St. Paul. Rabbi Glazer from Torah.com actually references St. Paul, Paul of Tarsus. And it seems that he shared this idea as well, which may kind of make sense because, you know, that's that Paul, Josephus, Philo, they're well within that early Jewish milieu, theological milieu, that had nothing to do now with post-Christian ideas. This is not pre-Christian ideas. Okay, and this is St. Paul's letter to the Galatians, chapter 4, verses 22. It is written that Abraham had two sons, one by a slave woman and the other by a free woman. One, the child of the slave, was born according to the flesh. Okay, the Greek word there is sakris, the flesh. The other, the child of the free woman, meaning Sarah, was born through the promise. Okay, stop right there. Why is St. Paul making a distinction between flesh, which is Isaac, I'm sorry, which is Ishmael, sorry about that, flesh, which is Ishmael through Hagar, the slave woman, and Isaac through Sarah, who was born through the promise? Why is one referring to flesh and one is not referring to flesh? Why is one referring, we could say, to something natural and we could say something to supranatural? Again, referring. So there's a tradition that Rabbi Glazer is saying from the ancient rabbis engaging in their interpretation called the Midrash, and that's the interpretation, the Jewish interpretation of the scriptures, with Philo of Alexandria and with St. Paul, that are all showing this well-established early belief and pretty well-known belief that Isaac was born through a divine conception, i.e. parthenogenesis, i.e. virgin birth. That is a pattern in the scriptures of God dealing with humanity when God directly intervenes within humanity, that he wants something done, something important, something that's directly going to benefit and positively affect his people, his covenant people, as well as people outside of the covenant. And it wasn't until after the birth of Jesus, the virgin birth of Jesus, that even Rabbi Glazer says that this was all disregarded. So this is what Rabbi Glazer says. Ironically, Paul's adoption of Philo's reading, which is of the divine birth of Isaac, and his application of the concept to Jesus likely sealed its fate among Jewish interpreters, meaning later Jewish interpreters. The New Testament traditions of Jesus' birth through the Holy Spirit, Matthew 1:18 and Luke 1:35, rendered any such idea of Isaac's, you know, virgin birth, you know, anathema, persona non grata. We're not going there. Even as it applied to Isaac, and even without the connotations of divinity familiar from Christian theology. Therefore, going forward from the time of Jesus on, Jewish tradition permanently rejected Philo's mystery of Isaac. Nevertheless, certain clues in the text point to the possibility that Philo was reading the Torah correctly all along. meaning the correct reading of the Torah was that Isaac was of a divine conception, a virgin birth. And again, that, and he even says it, that St. Paul picked up on this, made the allusion to Christ, that this was the biblical pattern. Of course, this is how God acts with humanity. It makes sense. That's why St. Paul quoted it or inferred it in Galatians.
Okay, I'm gonna put this out to you, see what you think. I'm gonna say it wasn't a virgin birth.
No, well, I see where you're going with that. When I say virgin birth, I'm talking about a divine conception from a 90-year-old woman that is not going to be having natural reproductive sex at that point. That's what I meant by that. That's why I think the better way of saying it is divine conception instead of virgin birth.
Oh yeah. Well, no, yeah. but I bring that up because I think that is an important difference between her and Mary and what makes Jesus's birth so special.
Right.
And because you know what I mean?
It goes to her holiness, her virginity.
Right.
Goes to her holiness, which is, yes, that's a whole other topic. You're absolutely correct about that. What I was trying to say and what Rabbi Glazer was trying to say is that both with Mary and with Sarah, there was no human father. You just had God divinely intervening to give these two women their children.
Yeah, no, and that's the thing that kind of that hit me and why I was kind of pondering it as we're talking about it, even though we thought about it before because we knew this was coming up, was like just the phrases like God's only begotten son.
The Greek term monogenesis is found in the New Testament. It's actually found in John 3:16. That's where we get term. Yeah, God's only begotten son. That's how we always interpreted it. The Greek word monogenesis, when we would read it as Greek speakers, as we always said, no, that's not what it means, only begotten son. Monogenesis actually means God's unique son, God's one and only special unique son.
Right.
Not only begotten. Okay, so why
interesting.
Why were speakers always saying that? Well, number one, that's what the Greek always meant.
Right.
Number two, that's now been confirmed from very recent findings in Egypt and the Middle East and other Hellenistic sites, where they see now from the morphology of the Greek or the linguistics of the Greek from these more recent discoveries that that's actually what was meant. The God's one and only unique special son. That's what Greek speakers always understood the word monogenesis to mean. That's now what modern findings of Hellenistic Greek and Koine Greek are confirming that term meant.
Right.
And the other reason why this is important is because there are a ton of sons of God in the Old Testament. There's a lot of them. Go back to Genesis 6. You've got sons of God all over the place there.
Yep.
Okay. Go to Job. First chapter of Job. Sons of God are right there in the divine council. You know, go to, I believe it's Deuteronomy 32, 33, verses 8 and 9. Sons of God. Okay. So you got sons of God all over the place. You go to Daniel. Sons of God. Why is Jesus God's special, unique son? Well, because when you go into the New Testament, the divine revelation that's given is the word monogenesis. And monogenesis means my one and only unique special son. There's nobody outside of Jesus that's like Jesus. Jesus is it. He is on a class all on his own that's different from all of these other sons of God. Because if Jesus was just another son of God, what's so special about him?
Right.
What's so special about him? In fact, you could also make a very perverse interpretation by saying, well, Jesus is just like those sons of God that we see in Genesis 6. No. So when it comes to the word monogenesis, the only begotten son of God, yeah, it's okay. It gets the flavor, but really it misses it because what it really means, my one and only unique son, my special unique son. There's only one Bible version, maybe two, that I know out there, and we've talked about it before. I think one is the Amplified version of the New Testament. I think that I believe the interlinear of the
New
interlinear
King James.
Of the New King James Greek New Testament, Greek English New Testament. But there's also another one that is the Lexingham Greek New Testament that actually also uses the phrase "my unique son." That's correct too. So those three English versions are actually correct in their translation of the word monogenesis. And I don't blame the older translations because, number one, a lot of times they didn't talk to us as Greek speakers. That's just, you know, we didn't have internet back then. We didn't have the amount of communication that we do now. And then number two, we didn't have the current archaeological findings of how Greek was actually understood, not just spoken, but understood until, you know, maybe the last 10 years, 5 years, where a lot of this stuff was coming out. So, you know, there's no blame to be cast there. The older translations, for what they had, did a really good job in translating that term. But now we know more. Now we know better. His one and only unique son, that whosoever should believe in him should not perish but have everlasting life. That's how that word monogenesis should now be translated.
For more info on the Bible Dig Godcast, please visit the Bible Dig Facebook page. And remember, when in doubt, just get diggy with it.